May it please the court. Good morning, Honor, counsel. My name is John Michaels, Jr. I'm representing the long-term disability plan for salaried employees of Champion International, which, for obvious reasons, I'm going to refer to as the plan. The defendant and cross-appellee in this case, the plan's appealing the district court summary judgment determination that it acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner when it found Ms. Tate unqualified for disability benefits under its terms. We are the cross-appellee on the issue of remand and attorney's fees, asking that the court uphold today the determination of the district court that remand is the appropriate remedy for the district court summary judgment determination and that there is no entitlement to attorney's fees at this stage of the litigation. Ms. Tate, just to very briefly, began receiving disability benefits effective July 1998. She received short-term disability benefits for a period of about 7 months, and then in February 1999, she began receiving long-term disability benefits, which are the claim at issue here. That continued until they were terminated at the end of June 2003. The long-term disability benefit plan that's at issue here operates on a two-tiered system. For the first 24 months, the claims are evaluated under what's called an own occupation standard. That is, the question is whether the claimant is totally disabled from performing her own occupation, the job that she had at her employer. After that 24-month period elapses, the claimant is evaluated under an any occupation standard, and that's the claim under which Ms. Tate's disability benefits were terminated here. Obviously, the first issue out of the gate for which we are the appellant is the termination of her benefits, which Judge Manning at the district court reversed. Our position, as laid out in the brief, is that there is not a requirement, as Judge Manning indicated in her opinion, there is not a requirement that the plan perform a vocational analysis or some kind of vocational testing or some kind of vocational inquiry into the claimant's or Ms. Tate's capabilities before making the benefits termination decision.
Could she have gone to a vocational expert and gotten an affidavit and submitted it with her application to the plan?
She could have, yes, Your Honor. And, in fact, I think that really is sort of the distinction that we make in the brief, and that is that it's her benefit to show that she's qualified for these plans. Ms. Tate, in her brief, argues that there's no vocational inquiry and that the physicians that made any inquiry in the...
Did she have her own doctor to support her application?
She had two physicians. She had a Dr. Caton and a Dr. Greenberg.
They're her own. And
they are her treating physicians.
So you're saying she could have gone to a vocational counselor also?
If she had, I think that would have made the case completely different. Once that vocational evidence comes in on her behalf, then I think that raises the level of inquiry that the plan is required to submit. What you have at this point with the plan's physicians, who Ms. Tate claims are unqualified to perform this kind of analysis, you have the plan's physicians making a vocational, they did make vocational inquiry. Ms. Tate argues that they're not qualified to assess whether she was disabled under any occupational standard, but she doesn't put any vocational evidence on her own. Her own physicians are not vocational experts or vocational evaluators. And under this circumstance, it appears that you've got exactly the kind of situation where this court has said court shouldn't inquire. You've got sort of a dueling experts situation where you've got individuals making reference, and the key up to the inquiry, of course, is whether there was a reasonable process followed, whether the plan has some reasonable basis for the decision that it made. In this case, you have two board-certified psychiatrists making the inquiry, reviewing all the medical records. Interestingly enough, they don't disagree with Ms. Tate's physicians in terms of the actual diagnosis. And Judge Manning at the lower court had no problem with the level of inquiry that was done by the plan. Where they disagreed and where the issue came up for the district court was this failure to make a vocational inquiry. In her brief, Ms. Tate argues that there's a requirement, or there should be a requirement, that the plan actually identify positions that she would be qualified to hold. That's nowhere in ERISA. It's certainly not in the plan document. And under these circumstances, there's no basis to hold the plan that kind of a heightened standard.
So your position is that she should, and that individuals who apply for this kind of relief, they should go out and get a vocational counselor. You're under no obligation to see if there's any position she could fill in the company.
The plan is under an obligation. Yeah, that's correct. The plan is under an obligation to make a reasonable inquiry into the nature of the disability and measure that disability against the standard that's in place. That was done in this case. The any occupation standard, the physicians that treated her found specifically that she came in under this standard. And again, it's a different standard than the standard for which she began taking long-term disability.
Well, don't you think that it's likely that there's always a job somewhere that someone can do, and that ERISA probably requires a little more than a denial of benefits on the basis that the plan participant can perform any occupation?
I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, in fact, in this case, the kind of I think, and I don't know whether how the district court evaluated this, but there was a vocational analysis made, in particular on the appeal. Dr. Center, once the claim was denied, Ms. Tate appealed. Dr. Center reviewed the case file. She reviewed work history. She reviewed job capabilities. She noted the fact, for example, that Ms. Tate had been working with the psychiatric conditions that formed the basis of her disability claim. She'd been working with those for years and did that kind of in-depth assessment of what she'd been able to do up to that point. I think that once these benefits get denied, what I would note is that there's some level of illness or disability that when the individual has that it's clear to the treating physician they are not going to be able to work at anything. And that's the threshold. Once they're above that threshold, the individual the plan simply has to provide a reasonable basis for making that call. Once that's done, Ms. Tate could have brought in vocational evidence saying, look, I can't hold any job, and here's why. My mood swings.
How far would you push that? It's a huge country. Presumably, if you're imaginative enough, you could find a job that was so light that anybody could do it. So in Social Security disability, the role of the vocational counselor is to estimate, you know, the number of jobs that this person might fill. And as long as there's a significant number in the region, then it's okay. But just finding one job in the United States that's this person might be capable of, that wouldn't be very... That's probably not what your plan actually contemplates, that you can do a nationwide search for the lightest job, feeding pets, feeding other people's pets. They bring them to your house, you give them a can of food.
I agree, Judge Posner. I agree that that is probably not what the plan contemplated, and there's no evidence in the record that when they did this assessment, they said, look, let's cast about and think for the most limited capacity, you know, zero wage, whatever you want to call it, job that we can find, and if we can get her into that, then she's qualified. That there's no indication that that's what that assessment meant. In fact, I would say that the evidence points in the other direction. They made a meaningful inquiry into her entire work history. They reviewed her vocational test. They reviewed her employment record. They reviewed her resume. They reviewed her work history. I'm sorry, but were you about to?
No.
Okay. So I don't think they were casting about saying, look, let's see where we can shoehorn the claimant into some terrible job somewhere. So under those circumstances, I think that they've met the test, the reasonable, you know, the test under COBS did the plan make an unreasonable determination when they made this finding regarding any occupation benefits? I think the record's pretty clear that they didn't. I think the record is also clear, and the case law is clear, that the burden to establish that, and it is a burden that goes to the claimant, the burden to establish that would have been pretty straightforward. Put in some vocational evidence that raises the threshold of inquiry that the plan has to make. The other issues on which we are the appellee relate to the remedy that was set up by the district court. Judge Manning remanded the case to the plan to follow up on the determination that it had made. She indicated that there had to be a vocational analysis or some kind of employability study, and that the plan ought to make that. Ms. Tate is appealing that, saying that the proper remedy would have been reinstatement of all benefits, and that the nature of that inquiry has to do with the status, Ms. Tate's status, at the time the benefits were terminated. Our position is that because there's no evidence that anybody anywhere in the plan history had decided that she was or had indicated that she was taking benefits under anything other than this own occupation standard, this was an initial evaluation under the any occupation standard at the time they made it in 2003. Once they made it there, it's functionally the equivalent of a new analysis. She comes in under a new standard. She's not been receiving benefits under that standard. And as a result, once the court, if the court determines that there was some kind of failure to properly comply with the terms of ERISA in the evaluation, once the court determines that, the proper remedy under Quinn and other precedents from this court, the proper remedy is to send it back to the plan. You didn't get it right the first time. Reset it, consider these additional factors, and reevaluate. To do something otherwise puts the claimant in a position in which she's actually getting a much better benefit than she would have had. So our position is that there is no evidence in the record that this was anything other than an initial determination on this issue. And in fact, the proper remedy is to send it back to the plan, let the plan make the assessment if that's what the court directs. Let the plan make that assessment, reevaluate the claim, and move the process forward. And I see I'm getting into my rebuttal time. I'll go very briefly. The last issue is one of attorney's fees. At this stage of litigation, we maintain, and I think it's pretty clear from our brief, that attorney's fees are not warranted. The claims and the position that was taken by the plan throughout this litigation has not been unjustified. In fact, the district court itself said that the record is not devoid of evidence supporting this position. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Mr. Dubofsky.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dubofsky. I represent Joanne Tate. The problem with the defendant's argument is that the defendant completely ignores the guiding precedents from this court. This court looked no further than the case of Hackett versus Xerox, which this court decided in 2003, to note the similarities between the decision in that case and the facts of this case and how this case should have come out. In the Hackett case, this court stated, Xerox provided no explanation for believing Dr. Holman's opinion over the opinions of the previous doctors. There was no weighing of the evidence for and against, and there was no articulated reasons given for Xerox's rejection of the evidence that Hackett was unable to work. Conclusions without explanation do not provide the requisite reasoning and do not allow for effective review. And that's exactly what took place here. We had two doctors review the file in the face of very well-detailed findings by Drs. Caton and Greenberg describing Ms. Tate's mental impairment and the fact that her functioning was so limited that she had difficulty managing basic activities of daily living, such as feeding herself or taking care of her home. Despite those findings, the first reviewer, Dr. Tash, claimed that Ms. Tate was never disabled, even though the plan had found her disabled after an independent medical examination conducted by Dr. Henry Conroe in 1999.
Can we just go back to Hackett for a minute?
Sure.
Because the court there found that the procedures employed by the plan were arbitrary and capricious. And since the procedures were flawed, the administrator had no basis to determine whether the benefits should be retroactively terminated. But here, it wasn't the procedures that were flawed. It was the administrator's decision that was flawed. So isn't that a distinction?
No. The procedures were equally as flawed in this case. In fact, it could be argued that in Hackett, the procedures were even better than the procedures in place in this case because the plan...
What is your complaint about the procedure here? I don't get it.
The main complaint about the procedure here is one that's noted in the plan's claim record. Why wasn't an independent medical examination done? At the time that the claim was submitted, the plan...
I'm saying every one of these disability determinations requires an independent medical exam?
I'm not suggesting that, but I am suggesting that a psychiatric case is quite different than a case...
So every psychiatric case has to be a medical exam?
Perhaps.
Wait a second. I'm worried about that. What I sense in your position is an attempt to transform these disability determinations into the Social Security disability process with its vocational experts and its, you know, formal procedures and rules and so on. I don't see a basis for that.
That's not what I'm suggesting, although obviously I am suggesting that the guidance from the Social Security procedures would be helpful in this case.
I don't agree with that. I mean, that's a government program. It's got government officials, you know, administrative law judges, and a benefits review program. It's an elaborate statutory regulatory scheme, and I don't think we're authorized to graft that onto these private disability plans.
Your Honor, we can put that issue aside, and we can focus on the specifics of this case.
You do seem to think that they have an obligation, that the plan has an obligation to hire a vocational expert.
In many cases, the plan does have an obligation, and this court found that in the Quinn case.
I understand that. But no, I don't think Quinn is. I don't think that Quinn is. Quinn is where you have an issue of comparability of jobs. That's the sort of thing you might think. Well, comparability of jobs is not a medical issue. That's an issue about what a job requires. That I understand. But I don't think it follows that in every disability case the plan has to hire a vocational expert,
and that's,
as is required in Social Security disability.
And that's not what we've suggested. The main point that we're trying to make in this case is that the treating psychiatrist and the treating psychologist have issued specific clinical findings. Two reviewing psychiatrists talked to those doctors, reviewed their reports, and then reached different clinical findings without ever conducting a clinical examination. And that's the particular weakness in psychiatric issues, because a psychiatrist can only make a clinical judgment from seeing the patient. This isn't something like looking at an MRI or a heart scan.
I don't understand that. I don't know why you say that.
Because how can Dr. Center say that there are no serious psychiatric impairments when the treating doctors both concur in saying that this individual cannot perform activities of daily living? How can she possibly have the qualification to make that statement without conducting any type of a clinical examination? And the problem is that...
Well, I mean, what if the doctors who diagnose her give a detailed description of the basis of their diagnosis, and the reviewing doctors say, well, we've looked at what you based your diagnosis on, and we don't think that that's persuasive.
And that could possibly be the case in a spinal impairment case, a cardiac impairment case, but I don't see how a reviewing doctor can disagree with something that a psychiatrist or a psychologist has come up with as the basis or following a clinical examination. That's where the distinction lies.
Well, what if a psychiatrist said that I interviewed the patient and she says she has trouble sleeping and she doesn't have very good appetite. And from that, I concluded that she suffers from clinical depression and is incapable of working. Well, someone reviewing that file could say that's not persuasive at all.
But that's not what happened here. The two doctors...
But the point is, there's nothing about psychiatry which says that it's never possible by reviewing a psychiatrist's notes of his diagnosis to disagree without actually talking to the patient.
I guess on that point we disagree, but turning back to the specific facts of this case, both doctors...
Well, you're asking us then to adopt a rule that no request for disability benefits on the basis of a psychiatric condition can be turned down unless the plan orders an independent medical examination of the person.
Not necessarily so, but in this case, absolutely.
Well, when we tie that to the plaintiff's burden, because you agree that it's the participant's burden to show she's unable to work in any occupation, there's no dispute there, right?
Not after she's been found disabled to work in any occupation. And I call the court's attention to pages 182 and 184 of the record, where the plan did in fact find that she met the any occupation standard.
Well, why should the plan have to identify specific jobs if the participant has the burden of showing she can't work at all?
Because the ERISA law imposes the burden on the plan to tell the participant what evidence would be needed to perfect her claim. This came out at the end that there was never any communication to Ms. Tate that she should go out and get a vocational evaluation. If the court looks at the denial letters are very similar to the denial letter that was criticized by this court in Halpin versus Granger. It's conclusory. It adopts one position. It doesn't weigh the evidence in any respect. And the bottom line, and what seriously troubled Judge Manning, is that Dr. Center, the second reviewer, says that this individual is going to suffer from psychiatric impairments for an extended period of time, yet says she can work without giving any indication as to how those impairments might impact on her ability to work. Every other case that this court has considered, Davis versus Unum, Semien versus Life Insurance Company of North America, those cases involved vocational evaluations. Those cases involved medical opinions where the doctors stated, these are the impairments and these will impact on this individual's ability to work. You have two doctors who reviewed this file and agreed that Ms. Tate would have these psychiatric impairments, yet they give no indication as to how those impairments would impact on her ability to work. And that's the distinction in this case. And that's exactly what happened in the Hackett case. The Hackett case is right on point because it's exactly the same situation where an individual qualified for benefits for a period of time, yet there was no indication given as to why the one doctor who examined and the one doctor who reviewed disagreed with the treating doctor. ERISA requires weighing of the evidence for and against. And Hackett is also directly on point in this case with respect to the remedy. And here's where we part company with Judge Manning and her finding below. Because at pages 182 and 184 of the record, the plan explicitly found Ms. Tate met the any occupation standard. That brings this case within the purview of Hackett, within the purview of Schneider versus Century Group, and within the purview of the earlier Halpin case. In all of those cases, the preferred remedy is to reinstate. Because, as Hackett pointed out, the plan is free to continue reviewing the claim. And they may later find that Ms. Tate no longer qualifies for benefits. And in fact, if there was a remand, they might have found that they didn't believe that she qualified for benefits. But they can never find anything other than the fact that the denial or the termination of benefits was arbitrary and capricious. And that's the reason why the benefits must be paid and reinstated rather than this case be remanded to the plan for an opportunity to do what they should have done in the first instance and make a reasoned determination weighing the evidence for and against as the ERISA law requires. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dubofsky. Mr. Michaels, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Very briefly, Your Honor. I think I could just direct immediately a comment to the fact that page 182, 184 of the record, that there's a finding that the plan approved Ms. Tate under the any occupation standard. That's incorrect. In fact, that was something that had been rejected by Judge Manning at the lower court. In fact, Judge Manning noted in the May 2003 determination that Tate was not eligible for any occupation benefits. She noted that the plan advised Tate that you are not totally disabled from any occupation, as opposed to advising her that she was no longer totally disabled from any occupation. And that's the distinction where Hackett falls as well. Under Hackett, the individual in question had been receiving benefits under the same standard for, I believe it was 12 years. And then the court came, or the plan came in and made a just out of the blue finding with no justification. That goes right to what I think is the heart of the court's point on the issue of the summary judgment determination concerning whether the plan followed the rules. And that's this. On page 21 of her memorandum, Ms. Tate says that the plan physicians did not accurately, and that's the word she uses, accurately describe any material improvement in her condition. And that really is the issue. Did they accurately, the disagreement is not with the procedure they followed. The disagreement is not with the evidence that they collected. The disagreement is not with the basis that they had with the decision. It's just that they came to a different conclusion. That's exactly the kind of decision that this court has said that court should not get into and should not wade into. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel.